The goal is to try and build neuromodulation-aware deep networks that are informed by principles of neuromodulation. Simply because there is no one-size-fits-all for neuromodulatory function, and it really depends on the brain region, the neuromodulator, and the cell type.
We just wanted to open like this discussion that there are really like all these neuromodulatory effects at different levels, including the fine dendrites, and the cell can really behave differently under different contexts. And that I think that's also like one point of the paper. And so we really want to bring that into a scope.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hey everyone, it's Paul. So on the previous episode, I had Eve Martyr on the podcast. And one of the things that Eve has done, among many others during her career, is study the effects of neuromodulation on neural networks. In her case, on a rather small neural network in crustaceans. But that conversation focused more on overarching principles and less on neuromodulation itself. On today's episode, I speak with Srikanth Ramaswamy and Zhe Mei. So Sri recently started his neural circuits laboratory at Newcastle University, and Mei is a postdoc at Western University. And I thought it would be a good time to have them on because they recently collaborated on a review that is focused on how principles of neuromodulation might benefit deep learning networks. So in this episode, we dig deeper into neuromodulation itself and how it affects brain states and dynamics, and how these principles might improve deep learning models, both in terms of their capabilities and in terms of modeling brains. So in the computational neuroscience world, there's always the question of how much biological detail is needed to create good models. And of course, the answer depends on the question that you're asking. But Sri and Mei believe that as we learn more about neuromodulators and different neuromodulator systems and how they interact to affect the landscape of ongoing neural net activity, it could lead to big improvements in model function without necessarily needing to just keep scaling up to bigger and bigger models. And they believe we're just at the beginning of understanding those neuromodulation principles. And it's clear that we're at the beginning of efforts to incorporate them into deep learning models. I also solicited a guest question from Mac Shine, who has been on the podcast before and is also interested in these topics. You can find the show notes at braininspired.co/podcast/131, where I also link to the review that I mentioned, which is called Informing Deep Neural Networks by Multiscale Principles of Neuromodulatory Systems. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. I wanted to start a little bit with your background. So Sri, I know that you were a big part of the Blue Brain project, which is a very different beast. So how did you, and we'll talk about that project a little bit more in relation to this, but how did you come to be interested in neuromodulators?
So as you said, when we were trying to tame this whole beast, detailed model, probably the most detailed model that we ever built on the somatosensory cortex, well, we integrated all this hard-won anatomical and physiological data at the cellular and the synaptic level and integrated this really into a complex microcircuit level model. But when we turned on the switch, when we simulated this model, we were slightly disappointed because the model wasn't doing anything terribly exciting. All it was doing was to fire in highly synchronous bursts of action potentials. So that really got us wondering, what is this model doing? It's almost resembling like an epileptic cortex. So what do we need to do to get it right? And that was when there was a bit of a eureka moment, when we realized that, hey, look, we've been building this model based on data obtained from brain slices, which are all typically done at high levels of extracellular calcium. But lo and behold, in the intact brain, the levels of extracellular calcium are actually lower about 1 millimolar, 1 to 1.2 millimolar. So what we then realized was we had to drop the levels of extracellular calcium in this detailed microcircuit model for it to try to do something similar to the intact brain. And that's when we came about, that's when we thought about of ways to really decrease the level of extracellular calcium by reducing the transmitter release probability of synaptic connections in the model. And then the emergent dynamics of the model began to make a lot more sense. It was a lot more desynchronous that kind of collaborated with what the intact brain was doing. But the brain has myriad ways of doing this, right? So, of course, changing calcium is probably one way that we could do with this model. But another way, another huge spectrum that the brain tries to employ to change these network dynamics is through neuromodulators like acetylcholine, right? So, acetylcholine, the way it acts, to, for example, to change the brain from sleep to wakefulness is really by modulating network activity from synchrony to desynchrony. So that's when we realized that there could also be other mechanisms at play to bring about this change in network dynamics. And that's really what got me interested in neuromodulation.
So May, how did you come to be interested in neuromodulators and neuromodulation?
So I have a background as a computational neuroscientist, and I did a computational neuroscience project, of course, in my master's studies. And I was working at the CNRS near Paris, was hosted by Yves Reignac and Andrew Davison. So like this thing, I started working on to simulate the sensory perception in the visual thalamus. And we had a really biologically detailed model, which means we use the morphologies of the compartments of the entire neuron to make a neural network. So, or we call that neural network because that's what represents the detailed characteristics of neurons. So that's why we call that neural network. So we also had like recorded cell responses from, for example, the thalamic cells, including the principal relay cells and also reticular cells. And the motivation of this project was that one of the PhD candidate at the lab, he was trying to do the same using a different simulator called NEST. And he was not really able to capture or replicate the properties of visual thalamus cells that they have recorded and observed in experimental studies. So that's why we discussed that might be an interesting chance to introduce more biologically detailed modeling work. And at that time, I was using another simulator called a neuron simulator. And we kind of played with the really fine mechanisms, including the L-channel kinetics and as well as neuromodulators using the mod files of the neuron simulator. And we actually saw a big difference when we had these mechanisms really implemented in details or partly impaired. So, and also I was really able to replicate this visual perception phenomena we have observed in, reticular cells and principal relay cells biologically. So that's how I got interested in the whole thing, because, having these mechanisms can really introduce the big difference in the neuronal properties as well as the network properties and also the connectivity in between neurons. And I think this is a big drive for me. And because I have also seen other approaches in, computational neuroscience that are using primarily point neurons. And when we are simulating after the same thing, we see big differences. And also in deep learning, it's even more abstract. We have, units as neurons that are storing for the error and for the back propagation. So I think after seeing all these different approaches, it got even more interested in how, we can add this biological realism to this model to make a difference.
So in some sense, both of your background work has focused on more or less a bottom-up approach, right? Build in all the details and run the simulation and kind of see what happens. But deep learning networks is a different beast, right? It's very much a fit whatever model you do build, however much biological detail there is, fit it to some behavior based on some behavior, which is in essence a top-down approach. I know one of the criticisms, at least of the Blue Brain project, is that the bottom-up approach of just building all the details, turning it on, running it, and seeing what happens is like fundamentally flawed, right? but I know that you both appreciate both the bottom-up and top-down approach. So how do you guys think about bottom-up versus top-down? And Sri, I don't know if you want to just respond to like that kind of criticism of Blue Brain in particular, but just in the larger picture, bottom-up versus top-down.
Right. I think what this convergence of bottom-up versus top-down buys us is so traditionally, all these top-down approaches have been a bit ad hoc because they've always been built to reproduce a very specific phenomenon, right? So these top-down models are great at reproducing something specific, but they probably can't reproduce something that's a lot more general. Whereas on the other hand, what a bottom-up approach affords us is a framework or a reference that could be used to try and understand what level of detail is required to model what phenomenon. And then based on what level of detail is required, I mean, you could then just shave off these details and then only focus on what matters to contribute to a certain phenomenon. So in some sense, I think a purely top-down, a purely bottom-up approach, is really a beacon, a guide to try and tell top-down approaches on what details matter and what could be included in order to reproduce a specific phenomenon. Because otherwise, I think if these two approaches don't come together, I think it's a bit of a groping in the dark. Because indeed, top-down models can tell us a lot about what's happening, but they might not really be able to pinpoint what are the finer details, the cellular and the synaptic details, for example, that are responsible to shape a certain phenomenon. So this is where I think the convergence of bottom-up and top-down approaches is very crucial.
Yeah, so mostly people will say there is actually a clear dichotomy between top-down and bottom-up. But I mean, I've seen people really driving through this research using a hybrid approach, for example, that has been used in the philosophy of computational neuroscience. And one of the example I've seen is Alain Destek's works published in 1999, I think. And I think he was trying to work on a reticular cell, principal relay cell, again, like the thalamic cells. And the thing he was doing is that he has a really detailed morphological reconstruction of this cell. So up to more than 200 compartments within a cell. And he also wanted to see what's the level of detail he required to replicate the sensory phenomena. And he also tried to reduce the amount of compartments in this model to, I think, around 70 or 3 or 10 or something. So I think also within the computational neuroscience community, there are a lot of people that are interested in trying to, you know, find the more, you know, gross details that are required to replicate without going into too much detail, because otherwise we may require a lot of computational power to really have a model running, especially, you know, considering that the brain has a great amount of neurons. And if we all incorporate this kind of level of details into that, it's going to it's going to lead to endless simulations. Yeah. And in the meantime, I think what's interesting about the current trends in the deep learning community is that we have more and more work coming in the directions of having a hybrid model in between these two approaches. For example, we have, I think, from Blake Richards' lab in 2017, where they had a deep neural network, but for the single units, they have tried to replicate a compartmental setting. So they had an apical dendrite instead of just a single neuron. And in the meantime, we have also seen work from DeepMind where they try to capture, you know, the fairing of these DNN cells or the activity DNN cell throughout the field when the agent's navigating. Mm-hmm. So I think we have a more recent appreciation of this hybrid approach by really having some top-down, you know, approach, and we try to add more finer details to see if that's leading to something different. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so thinking back to the, you know, early days of neural networks, right? I mean, in one sense, that was bottom-up because it was saying, well, the brain is made up of neurons, so let's make a network of neurons and then kind of go from there. But of course, then the training, you know, to do tasks is the more top-down approach. But so we'll talk about neuromodulators, and you give examples in the paper of various neural networks incorporating neuromodulation into the networks. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's a call for more of that. And May, you're talking about even using like dendritic computation to build that into neural network models. And of course, there are even neural network models with glial cells and their, you know, functional roles. So in some sense, it's, well, I don't know if it's a small trend or in some sense, it's a trend to see if these different kind of detailed microcircuitry and, you know, inductive biases, dendritic computation, neuromodulation, in some sense, there is a push to start building these things into the models. But like you said, it becomes intractable computationally. So my question, I suppose, is, what is the right level of abstraction? And you might just echo what you just said, that we have to, you know, figure out what is needed to constrain. I mean, Sri, you were talking about the original, like, modeling the calcium in the system and then having to change that. And then that's what got you onto neuromodulators in the first place. But it's almost overwhelming to think about the detail to add into a neural network computationally, demandingly. So how do we know what the right detail is?
The so-called right level of detail or the correct level of detail really depends on the kind of questions you want to answer, right? So Chris Elliott-Smith wrote this review many years ago. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, the title of this review is the Use and Abuse of Large-Scale Neural Network Models, something along these lines, right? So it really boils down to the kind of question you want to ask. So if, for example, I would like to know the role of oblique dendrites of layer 5 pyramidal cells in modulating gamma oscillations in the neocortex, then I better model them. Otherwise, I won't know what these dendrites are doing, right? Yeah. So it really boils down to the kind of question you want to answer. And yes, sure, adding all this detail might seem daunting, but to a certain extent, it's not about this all-encompassing model that's like a silver bullet, but it's more of like a framework that lets you add the kind of detail you would like to. And then if at the end of the day, you realize that this detail is not letting you answer the kind of questions you want to, then sure, feel free to isolate this level of detail and then see what really is contributing to the kind of phenomenon you would like to explore. So in that sense, I think detail is not daunting. It is necessary. But what we need to understand is how to incorporate this in the most economical way possible, because adding more detail, of course, as May said, implies a lot more computational power. There's the need to be judicious about adding detail. But on the other hand, this detail is there for a certain reason. We don't know what the reason is. So unless we have some room, some placeholder to include this detail, we'll never know what this detail is actually contributing to what we want, what we'd like to study. So I'd again like to reiterate on the fact that the level of detail depends on the kind of questions you'd like to answer.
And I feel that apart from the question itself also depends on the, there are some other factors that are more, you know, realistic. For example, the budget you have, the duration of the project, and also computational power you have. So like sometimes we are bound to the amount of machines we have and we cannot really go like into any further details. And I think there is also like something in addition to this point is that in some cases, the brain's energy consumption is actually one interest question. So it optimizes itself in some way. So it optimizes the cost function, or it optimizes the neurons, the way the neurons are communicated, and like how the connectivity is enhanced or reduced in a certain area, and uses sleeps and rest cycles to restart the some certain states of the brain. And I think these are quite interesting as well, because there are actually some active neuroscience research studying why the brain is so energy, you know, efficient. Mm-hmm. And this is something we can also try to think you know, from a perspective in the way that we can maybe potentially tackle this highly computationally costly, you know, problem that we have in deep neural networks and also biologically detailed neural networks. Yeah.
Right, May, but yes, I mean, resources, that's something. But on the other hand, let's assume you had infinite resources, right? So what would you then do? like where would you stop to add all these details, right? So that's another thing. Like, yeah. Would you go down to the level of proteins or single genes? Mm-hmm. Like what would you do?
I agree with what you said. Yeah. Yeah. So the question matters.
Right. So I mean, ultimately, I think to some extent, it boils down to what you'd like to answer.
Yeah.
So sure, the energy consumption part, that's indeed very important.
Mm-hmm.
That also boils down to what computing resources we have. I mean, whatever computing architectures we have right now are quite energy greedy. So at the end of the day, perhaps to make these computing architectures also more energy efficient, we would need to understand how the brain's implementing this energy efficiency. And to do that, perhaps we need to build models of some level of detail. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't know why the brain's so energy efficient, right? So I think it's a bit of a chicken and an egg problem in my opinion. So
I personally prefer that if I have sufficient details that make something work, I won't really go into any more details unless the mm-hmm. details are the things I wanted to study. So what I think Sheree is right on the point that it depends on the question I wanted to answer. If I wanted to replicate a cognitive processes or phenomena, so in that case, if the details I have are sufficient, maybe I'm going to just try adding more detail to try to play with that. Yeah, but if I wanted to study the details themselves, I definitely want to go into another level of details. So it depends. Yeah. And also there's really no right or wrong level of details because we also we all say that all the models are wrong, but some are useful. So, you know, in that way, I think the right level really depend on the question you wanted to answer. If this is a thought experiment that we have, you know, unlimited power and computational resources. So I think that's the point of, you know, the first thing you want to define is a question you want to answer. And then what are the models you can potentially use to answer this question? And then what is the main, most simplistic model you can try to go from? And what is the detail, level of detail we want to stop with maybe? So that's how I would frame it.
Yeah. So May, you just said the right level of detail is the level of detail that makes it work. And Sheree, when you were talking, you alluded to Chris Eliasmith, who's been on the podcast, and his viewpoint. And one of the things that actually Chris Eliasmith focuses on is, for his purposes, what makes it work is if it matches behavior, right? So he has mm-hmm. this cognitive architecture spawn. And in the paper that you guys wrote, you go through a lot of literature detail in neuromodulators and how they're related to our cognitive functions and what we know about how they interact and the different mappings of a particular neuromodulator onto various cognitive functions. Mm-hmm. Do we know enough about, for example, dopamine, right? So the classic reward prediction error, that's what it is, except it also plays 17 other different roles that are being discovered all the time, right? And then you have, on top of dopamine, you have all the other neuromodulators. So for instance, Sheree, I know you're interested in histamine specifically, among others. Do we know about the relation between neuromodulation and cognitive functions and behaviors and how the neuromodulators interact? Or is that part of the project to learn more about these things by developing them into deep neural networks?
Okay. I think it's a bit of both because we definitely are really at the tip of the iceberg when it comes to neuromodulating function. So what these neuromodulators are probably doing is analogous to a relay race, right? So one neuromodulator sets the stage for another to take over. So one neuromodulator passes the baton on to another neuromodulator mm-hmm. to take over, to then capitalize on a platform that's already built to then prime the brain to do something, right? So So neuromodulatory function depends on brain state. And for the brain to reach a particular state, it needs to activate certain neuromodulators, right? A combination or whatever. So it's really this synergistic effect that's going on throughout, where the brain needs to get to a certain state and you can't get there without neuromodulators. And these neuromodulators are constantly priming the brain to get to a particular state. So in this way, it's a very synergistic problem. And we're only beginning to appreciate what these permutations and combinations in terms of neuromodulatory effects are. But a lot of this is being studied at the global level, at the behavioral level. Mm-hmm. So while we appreciate that a certain neuromodulator like dopamine, as you said, which is probably doing 17 different things in addition to reinforcement or reward prediction error, there are also other neuromodulators that are very likely causing the dopaminergic system to execute these functions,
yeah.
Right? So we're like studying what's happening at the global level, but there's a lot more that's happening at the local level because there are a lot of different cell types. Like, let's just take the example of the neocortex, right? I've tried to build in collaboration with the Blue Brain Project, a little crumb of the somatosensory cortex that's roughly the size of a grain of sand, right? About 0.3 millimeter cube of cortical tissue. So this little crumb of cortical tissue has about 55 different morphological types. So combinatorially speaking, 55 different morphological types, assuming all-to-all connectivity, would lead to 55 square or 3,025 yeah. possible synaptic connection types. But we know, again, by virtue of axodendritic geometry, that only about 2,000 or so of these 3,025 combinations are biologically viable because the axons of some cell types cannot reach the dendrites of others to form synapses, so on and so forth, right? So over the past 50 years or so, we've been doing wholesale recordings of these synaptic connections. We only have quantitative data on 20 or so of these synaptic connection types. So that's less than 1%, right, of the 2,000 or so biologically viable connection types. And of these 20 or so that we have data on, we probably know what a neuromodulator like acetylcholine might be doing to less than 10 of these combinations. So the data on the effects of neuromodulators on synaptic transmission alone is extremely sparse. Yeah. So we just don't know what's happening at the local level. So the need of the art to try and understand neuromodulation is to build these bridges between what's happening locally at the cellular and synaptic level, and then try and connect this to what could be happening at the global behavioral level, but we are not there. So of course, this asks the question, is there any incentive in doing all these 2,000 or so wholesale recordings and applying acetylcholine? There probably isn't. So we need to come up with clever ways to try and understand some predictive patterns on what could be happening at the cellular and synaptic level due to a single neuromodulator like acetylcholine. Like, it could be that pyramidal cells all have similar receptors expressed on their dendrites for acetylcholine. So perhaps acetylcholine could be having the same kind of effects. We don't know. So unless we break down this problem into something a bit more tractable, it's going to be a real challenge to understand what these neuromodulators are doing across cell types, even in a small part of the brain. So I think the need of the art is to really try and come up with approaches to bridge levels of detail to try and understand how the local modulation, the local effect of neuromodulators translates into something more global, something at the behavioral level.
Yeah, so I think what's interesting about the neuromodulators is that there are like a lot of more modern technological approaches allowing for different explorations from the in vivo, in vitro, and in silico perspectives. So according to what Sri said, like there are many kind of interactions across the types of neuromodulators. For example, as he mentioned, you know, dopamine can only achieve its goals, you know, under the modulation of other neuromodulators, such as I think acetylcholine as well as serotonin, because there are opponents existing between serotonin and dopamine the way they're counting for punishment and rewards respectively, and it also has a lot of implications in the cognitive disorders, and of course another kind of a principal example, if it's a cholinergic regulation of dopaminergic cell activities within the basal ganglia that has a lot to do with the movement initiation execution in Parkinson's disease. So, I mean, I think what's interesting to us is that we have seen these neuromodulatory processes at all different spatial temporal scales. And these are from one aspect, these are not so finely defined in deep neural networks. So this is something we can try to incorporate. And there are a lot of evidence on that, computationally and experimentally. And of course, we computational neurosciences, we use different approaches. And of course, we can try to work with deep learning practitioners to have a hybrid approach between biologically detailed modeling and deep neural networks. And the second thing is that we are not only using computation models to kind of replicate it, we also wanted to use these models to have a better, you know, refined computational hypotheses on how these areas might be interacting with each other. For example, if you're, you know, if you're trying to use an in vivo approach to kind of a patch clamp some cells in a certain brain area, for example, like the midbrain nucleus, such as you know, the basal ganglia striatum, for example. And these are some areas that are really hard to reach using the traditional experimental approaches. So yeah, I was really fortunate when I was working at Gilly Silberberger's lab in 2015, and I witnessed like kind of the first patch clamping session in the world on cholinergic neurons in the basal ganglia. So, I mean, yeah, it's really nice for me. I was working with Ramon and a really experienced postdoctoral researcher by that time. So, I mean, for these areas, my point is that it's really hard to explore, you know, in vivo. And we used awake behaving animals, and these experiments are really hard to conduct because the animals are kind of performing and behaving all the time. After they receive is, for example, like sensor stimulus from the whiskers or stuff. And also like these,
These are patch clamps?
Yeah, patch clamps.
Awake behaving? Because I'm going to ask you a technical question in a second about that. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah,
sorry.
And then like these are areas are hard to patch from. And sometimes we have one or two neurons per day. That's already good enough. And So definitely if we can kind of replicate certain experimental conditions in computational models, that's going to help us have better computational, you know, hypotheses, and that can be tested using experiments further. So I think these experimental approaches and computational modeling really goes in a cycle and promote each other in a certain way, because we have better experimental results, we have more biological constraints in modeling, and if we have better models, we may have better hypotheses on what the biology is doing. So I think this is a quite, we are not only using this to really make better models, but we also use mechanistic models to create better hypotheses. So that's what I wanted to say here. Yeah.
Okay. So one of the drives for this, right? So from what you guys are saying, one of the drives for building in a neuromodulator at multi-scale, multiple different scales in multiple levels of detail, building them into deep learning models is to help us understand actually what's going on in the brain, right? And that's a lot of what we talk about on the podcast, is using deep learning AI methods to help us understand what's going on in the brain. But as I was reading your review, I thought the other way to go would be like, why not invent new neuromodulators for deep learning models and to see what they can do, right? Like, why not, instead of constraining the neuromodulators, thinking, well, acetylcholine does this in the brain, so let's build it in like that in a deep learning model. Why not invent a new neuromodulator that you somehow fit in the model, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we did that, would it come out that it would behave like acetylcholine, and then acetylcholine and histamine would interact the same way? Would we find that they were interacted the same way, or would there be other emergent properties that are good for the way that the models function? Sorry, it's kind of a out there question.
Well, that's an interesting question, I think. So right now, I don't think there are deep network models that try and incorporate mechanisms of specific neuromodulators. Perhaps in reinforcement learning, but they're all focused on dopamine.
But that's what you sort of propose, right, in the paper.
There's a different story for neurobotics because if you consider deep learning, so it's primarily people that are interested by interested in dopamine. And if you go to a bit of a neurobotics, you know, research, I mean, there are like research driven by certain neuromodulators, for example, studies done by Krishmar, and he has actually proposed different roles of individual neuromodulators and try to implement that all in one of the robot models. So I think all the different fields that take different approaches, and definitely we have seen more natural interest in reinforcement learning regarding dopamine. And I think one recent proposal by Uchida from Harvard is that we can try to incorporate acetylcholine in parallel with dopamine because these two interact a lot. So yeah, we have seen some interest in that field, but I think according to our knowledge, our paper is kind of actually kind of the first one to kind of try to push people to pay more attention to other neuromodulators, even like apart from the ones we mentioned in the paper. Yeah, also there's histamine, there's neuropeptides as well. So yeah, I think that's quite important. And also you mentioned like we may use another neuromodulator that's not really like a biological neuromodulator in the brain. I think I'm not sure about that, but I think there are some complementary effects achieved by having these neuromodulators working together in your brain. So maybe like the novel neuromodulator proposing is actually like the effects is equals what we have when the neuromodulators are working in combination, right? So that's a possibility.
But then it would be redundant because then if you're also modeling the two neuromodulators that then have that effects when they're working together, then why add a third, I suppose?
Right, but then this just reminds me of an ingenious a study where they invented a neuromodulator and they called it backpropamine. Right. But somehow the role of backpropamine, as is pretty self-explanatory, was kind of limited to backpropagation, which is interesting in itself. But we know for
but it was invented for backpropagation.
Yes, you're right. Yes, so it was invented for backpropagation. But indeed, I mean, there's clear evidence that depending on the kind of neuron and the brain region and the neuromodulator. So this is like a 3D problem. A neuromodulator, the brain region, and the cell type. That, of course, the definition of backpropagation in machine learning and the backpropagating action potential is a bit different. But nevertheless, these neuromodulators seem to have very specific effects in actually modulating the so-called backpropagating action potential in itself. Yes, I mean that could be completely new functions for neuromodulators in only modulating the so-called backpropagating action potential itself. So perhaps a fictitious neuromodulator like backpropamine could actually tell us something very new. So indeed, yes, there could be a new neuromodulator we have no idea about. Yes.
Okay, but to add one or two sentences to that study called backpropamine, naturally they were partly inspired by the habit learning, you know, when they were trying to build the connectivity in between neurons. And also they had a kind of a retroactive version of neuromodulation where you use actually like dopamine-inspired mechanisms for the change of the weight. So I think it's also, you know, it sounds like something totally novel, but actually it has the roots in dopamine as well as habit learning. So yeah, it's not like 100% novel or makeshift or made up neuromodulator. Yeah, but it's actually a novel work by combining the effect at the connected level as well as at the neuronal level. So I think that's quite an interesting study.
But what you're proposing in the paper, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is using what we do know about neuromodulators and their role in cognitive functions to build in kind of to constrain the models in that way.
Indeed, that's correct. So as the title of the paper itself says, so the goal is to try and build neuromodulation aware deep networks that are informed by principles of neuromodulation, simply because there is no one size fits all for neuromodulatory function. And it really depends on the brain region, the neuromodulator, and the cell type. Also, possibly the domain in a particular cell type, because there could be different receptors that are expressed in dendrites and axons. So indeed, yes, this is really the proposal, the grand proposal, and this is the direction that we would like to pursue.
Yeah, I mean, also this is, I think this is pretty much like a demonstration of what neuromodulators in the brain are doing. And we are aware of some of the problems the deep learning community is trying to solve. And like, these are problems that are tackled by the brain using this kind of adaptive design by the neuromodulatory system. So we think we can maybe like provoke some thinking in these new directions, and maybe like we can showcase, okay, this is how the brain does it by having a neuromodulatory system. I mean, this is like not a unified solution to all your problems, but these are like how they're tackling specific individual problems, you know, using all these systems and processes. And we wanted to kind of attract people and make them maybe ponder a bit more within this field. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So here's an unfair question I want to ask both of you. So it's two questions in parallel.
Mm-hmm.
On a scale of 0 to 100, 0 being like nothing and 100 being solved or perfect knowledge or something. So the first question is, where are we in our understanding of biological neuromodulators and their interactions and the whole world and how their roles, right?
Yeah.
0 to 100. And of course, there's a much longer history. And then the second question is, where are we 0 to 100 in terms of exploiting the potential of neuromodulators in deep neural networks?
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll probably take the first part. So where are we in terms of understanding neuromodulatory function, the role of biological neuromodulation on a scale of 0 to 100?
This is a hard probably question. Yeah, because you don't know what you don't know, right?
I'll be very generous. I'll say 3, maybe.
3, okay. Yeah, then that's generous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because the first step it takes you to know, like the big step is that you know what you don't know. So we don't know what we don't know. And that's one of the biggest issue here, right? So we don't know what's the boundary of this whole field. And it's making us even more not so confident when we're faced by this kind of questions.
So what would you go, higher or lower than 3?
I initially thought it's around 10 or something, but since Sri said 3 and he has definitely a more say than I do when it comes to experimental studies on the neuromodulation. So I think I'm gonna take it down to 5 or
So just to add to my choice of 3, so 3 is simply because we've always been studying neuromodulators mostly, or rather the function of neuromodulators, as though it's always a single neuromodulator that's doing something. Primarily because a lot of this knowledge comes from slice physiology, where the approach has always been to apply a certain agonist to the path and look at what's happening at the level of cells and synapses due to a particular neuromodulatory agonist. But this is clearly not how things are implemented in the intact brain, right? Like, as you said, Paul, there are all these interactions, and we simply have no idea to try and quantify these interactions. Of course, now we're slowly beginning to have the tools where it's possible to like genetically or rather express, I don't know, like ways to monitor, to simultaneously monitor the function of multiple neuromodulators through genetically expressed encoders and things like that in neurons. But we're still getting there, and we definitely have a long way to actually try and understand how neuromodulatory interactions are actually shaping a brain function. So hopefully I'll be a lot more generous and say and predict that three could probably go to around five or six in the next few years.
Okay.
So optimistic. The next few years. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, then, so the parallel question, and May, I'll ask you to answer that this one first, right? Where are we, 0 to 100, in terms of the potential of exploiting neuromodulation function in deep learning?
You mean the potential or the progress?
Progress, I suppose. And the potential is, let's say the maximal potential is 100.
Yeah, I mean, the progress is really, I would give it a...
She's going to go much more conservative
something
now.
Not exceeding 10, something under 5. Yeah, because we have, if you read this, a couple papers using so-called artificial neuromodulation in artificial neural networks, they have defined neuromodulation in a really loose term. So something that's adaptive,
right.
self-adaptive,
right.
And self-adjusting, self-refining based on feedback, or, you know, something that is locally applied to a certain subpopulation of a neural network, and this factor can kind of go adjusting itself, is called neuromodulation. So it's a really loose definition of neuromodulation. Yeah. I don't know if this is being critical or something, but it's definitely a fancy word to use by people. And of course, they have demonstrated different behavior benefits and learning benefits from having more like adaptive mechanism in their studies. But we really have loose definition of neuromodulation. It's not always biologically plausible, and they have been applied to neural networks of relatively small scale. So for example, we have reviewed a couple studies in the paper as well. So we initially had a table dedicated to that. Yeah, but we found, most studies we have observed in this field, so I think it's up to 10 or something. If you add neurobotics, going to be around 15-20, because we have more studies in this from neurobotics side. So, but if we only discussing pure DNN approach, I think mostly people were using these mechanisms, smaller network, because they have a better see-through of what it's doing from inside out. Yeah, and they were really applied to really tiny networks of sometimes naturally around 100 neurons. So they were trying to observe what each neuron is doing under different neuromodulatory factors that are kind of a scaling up the connectivity in between neurons, where they were trying to see if a simple network can adapt or can learn kind of a different association between stimulus and response, if we add a richer number of neuromodulatory factors. So I think from the scale of a neural network we have been using to investigate artificial neuromodulation is kind of a homogeneous. It's always mostly a small network, and we have only seen one or two studies applying this kind of a thing to a larger network from the connectivity level. For example, the Miconi paper is actually the Beck Proppman thing Shri discussed. And also from implementation level, there are like re-implementing all different ways. For example, it can be represented by a hyper network. It takes input from the deep neural networks and computes the hyper params it wanted to modify upon each sampling. Or it can be like represented as a novel activation function, or it can be represented as a scaling factor that are applied to the whole population or overlapping or non-overlapping subpopulations. So you can see there's a really wide, yet loose definition of neuromodulation, and people are trying to inject this into neural networks in different ways. So we all have different takes on that. And I hope there's a chance we can, having neuroscientists and deep learning practice and work together to have something that's more detailed, that's more in between, and we can test this in kind of a different architectures. And I think this is something, an interesting direction I'm currently probing at Western, and wanted to see more of these work coming instead of having a really loose defined and heterogeneous kind of objectives and studies. But of course, having different objectives, saying that we have observed the benefits at different level from different aspects. And that's also one interesting, I think, particularly interesting thing of current ongoing studies in this field.
Very good. Shreya, you need to say your number on the scale, and then because I wanted to respond to that, but I've got to make you say your number as well, and the why.
Well, I would still say, it's certainly much below 10. Let me stick to 5 now, or maybe even lower than that. Because, yes, as May said, I think indeed. So it's not like there haven't been any attempts to include neuromodulation in deep networks. But on the other hand, as I mentioned before, it really boils down to what element of neuromodulation that one would like to include in these deep neural networks, because it again really depends on the brain region, the cell type, and the neuromodulator. And right now, we still, at least in terms of implementing these details in deep neural networks, we're definitely not there yet, because of course we are of course very handicapped by the biological knowledge itself. Mm-hmm. It's another process to try and transform this biological knowledge into how we could implement whatever into deep networks. But there are some very global analogies, as May said, Kenji Doya's work from the early 2000s has always been very illuminating in setting the stage to kind of confer a specific hat to each of the so-called big five, or rather, would I say big four neuromodulators,
big four.
Acetylcholine, noradrenaline, dopamine, and serotonin. So indeed, Paul, as you mentioned before, I'm currently studying the role of histamine, because I think it's very underappreciated and has only been restricted to its role in regulating sleep and wakefulness. But I believe there's a lot more histamine could do. Therefore, I say the big five. But we know a lot more about the role the roles of the big four. Mm-hmm. We've been pretty good at assigning a specific hat to what each of these big four neuromodulators are doing. For example, acetylcholine in terms of gain normalization, or dopamine in terms of reward prediction error, and more recently serotonin and things like that. But we really need ways to try and identify the nuances of how these neuromodulators operate and their interactions indeed, because they don't operate in isolation. They always interact. Yeah. But the interaction bit is a little masked, and we need to understand how they interact and hopefully come up with ways to encapsulate and formalize the ways these neuromodulators interact into deep neural networks. So currently we don't have that, because we've only looked at neuromodulation as one global all-encompassing silver bullet. But this is clearly not the case. Mm-hmm. So we need ways to try and model the spatio-temporal specificities of neuromodulatory action into deep networks.
Yeah. So on top of that, there are also a lot of technological changes in both fields, and we have been observing different things thanks to them. And it means when we're trying to model after certain aspect or certain neuromodulator, we always update our model based on these new studies, right? For example, we have noradrenaline, which is traditionally thought that only having a really homogeneous distribution as well as function. But now recently, thanks to optogenetics, we have observed a really contact-dependent and also projection-dependent functions of this neuromodulator. So we definitely wanted to update our model based on what the experiments suggest, and which means we will never go there, but we will never be there, but we will get better and better. Yeah.
Well, May, I wanted to say, because you mentioned networks of 100 neurons.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why I wanted to have you guys on was because on the previous episode, I had Eve Martyr on. Mm-hmm. And she's famous for working on this approximately 30 neuron mm-hmm. system in the lobster stomatogastric nervous system and crab. And, one of the things that she's famous for is being struck and worried that, because the resilience of these networks under different sets of parameters, essentially, right? So you could throw, in terms of neuromodulators, and she doesn't specifically only focus on neuromodulators, but if you had a high concentration of noradrenaline or something, you might still get a nice rhythmic behavior from the system could produce nice oscillations, right? So this, it's an oscillatory system. And then in, you know, the crab moves south 100 yards or something, and then there's like a lower concentration of potassium or something in the seawater, and still you get these rhythmic concentrations, which goes to show how resilient even small networks can be. But also the worrying part is how to understand what those networks are doing. So because there are so many different parameters that work, and it's hard to crash the system. So then, you know, thinking about scaling up to such a massive neural network level, that actually seems then, you know, even more daunting. So how do you, because I know you're familiar with Eve Marder's work, how do you think about that smaller scale and how much we still don't know about that versus scaling it up to something much larger?
So indeed, I mean, one statement that Eve made many years ago at a garden research conference has always stuck with me and was also a factor to kind of motivate me to look at neuromodulatory function. So Eve said that the connectome is absolutely necessary but completely insufficient to understand the brain. So what she probably meant there was that, yes, I mean, there's the anatomical wiring diagram, the blueprint that's kind of carved in stone or not entirely. But yeah, this provides a set of instructions to the network. But what neuromodulators do is to act on top of these set of instructions to then confer a lot more flexibility to expand the set of instructions into a set of options. Mm-hmm. And indeed, in some sense, looking at the architecture of deep neural networks, I mean, their layered configuration and stuff like that, yes, so they are structured in a way to work with a set of options, but how exactly they hover around these options is something we don't know. And again, coming back to your question on complexity, sure, yes, we still don't know how this small network of 30 neurons the output of this small network of 30 neurons is going to be the same regardless of a lot of stuff that's going on deep down under. So how local components are being constantly reconfigured to end up with the same kind of result. And indeed, so this is also something that I've looked into as part of my own stint in the Bluebrain project. And this combinatorial explosion is indeed a problem. But of course, what we still don't know is how to relate neuromodulatory function and map it to a certain brain state. Because as I mentioned before, I think it's a synergistic role play in that getting to a certain brain state demands a certain a configuration of neuromodulators to act. And the brain can only get to a certain state if this combination of neuromodulators are activated. So I think if we could try and understand what are the specific neuromodulators that could actually function to get to a certain brain state, and how do they act on certain cells and synaptic connections, then I think this problem could be a little more tractable. And of course, to add to this, the whole new field of transcriptomics is actually a very good ally in trying to help us understand how this could work, because it could be that there are certain combinations of neuromodulatory receptors that are expressed in some cell types, you know, and looking at what are these receptor combinations and linking these receptor combinations to different neuromodulators, I think we could then try and predict how combinations of neuromodulators could actually act on the expression of certain receptors to help us or to help the brain get to a certain network state. And therefore, we wouldn't have to study all possible neuromodulators, but just try and understand the expression of certain receptors, how they correlate with the expression of receptor types of other neuromodulators. And if these are all expressed in high levels, then it could be that these neuromodulators that are acting on these different receptors are having a similar function. So I think these are some of the ways that we could try and harness to really break down this problem into something that's a bit more tractable.
Yeah, so apart from the biological constraints, when we are working with DNNs, and I think it's quite important to understand what each layer, where each layer is playing a role. And I think the one way is also to kind of work with the deep learning community to have better visualization tools and something from insight. I think this is something the community is currently working on, so explainable AI. Yeah, and try to kind of break down the black box. And for example, so now I'm working with biologically plausible pairing of deep neural networks. And so from this pairing, we can kind of have a more direct way to observe what's going on in between, you know, the neuronal connectivity and within each neuron. So we simply kind of visualize all the pairing pattern of cells in the fully connected layer, and we try to see if when we try to play with the adaptive factor or the modulatory factor within, you know, these layers, how it's going to affect the pairing pattern of the cells. And we have found something quite interesting that you know, the pairing is actually factor dependent. So if we play with the hyperparameter a bit, we can kind of change the pairing of the cells and also some distributions of the cells judging by their pairing pattern. So I think this is a really interesting observation, and we should really push that we have better visualization tools or computational tools to kind of understand what's going on in between each layer and have this as a dynamics. And one more thing is that we can also use you know, a shallower network at the beginning, and also we can try to play with different architectures and how this interacts with the neuromodulatory systems. And I think one interesting study done by Vicovan and colleague is that the robustness of a neural network when we have neuromodulation or not. So actually they found that as a network is more robust against different architectures when they have neuromodulation. I think this is something quite interesting. I mean, they may observe the robustness due to different factors. For example, like the internal working might be different, but they output the same result. But this is something, I think it's a function, a kind of a direction we can step into is how neuromodulation is affecting the general output and also inner working, you know, in addition to the output of a neural network as measured by accuracy or something in between, you know, like when we are trying to prove this question. And also in our paper, we propose to add, you know, in addition to the traditional global loss or something you want to have, especially in a feedback-based learning or continuous learning, we want to have something in between. You know, we want to have a more direct feedback from a task or like a smaller task-related, you know, learning or responses. And this way we can kind of capture it from a different spatial temporal scale. So this is more related to the temporal scale. Yeah, we can have kind of more like a frequent sampling of the you know, learning trajectory.
Going back to something that Sri said about, you know, Eve Martyr, and she actually used the same quote that structure is necessary but not sufficient to explain function, right? I don't remember if we actually spoke about this on the episode with her, but, you know, one of the things that they found in simulating 5 million, I'm going to make this up, 5 million different simulations with different sets of parameters, right? That the actual space out of 5 million that were viable was pretty low, but it as a percentage, but it was still like in the hundred thousands, right? of parameter spaces that would work. So yeah, I mean, it's constraining, but it's still quite daunting. Mm-hmm. So guys, I'm aware that our time is pretty close here. I have a guest question from Mac Shine.
Okay.
And so in the question, Sri, he's talking to you, but you know, the question is for both of you. So I'm going to play it through the phone here.
Okay.
Hi, Sri. This is Mac. So we're both really interested in how different arms of the ascending arousal system release neuromodulatory chemicals that change the firing rate and plasticity of areas of the brain like the cerebral cortex and the thalamus. But I would say that we take quite different approaches. I've been interested in trying to understand the basic principles underlying the interactions between the neuromodulatory system and the circuitry of the brain, whereas you've really dove down into the details and embraced the complexity of an area like the cerebral cortex and all of the different types of cells that exist there. And I wonder if you have any ideas about how to join the dots here, how to extract basic principles from the brain, but also really understand the exquisite detail that's present.
Okay, so that, you know, we've already touched on this topic throughout the conversation, but there's the question.
Right. I think one way to do this is really to harness this whole approach of optogenetic recordings in in the intact brain. Right. We really have these very specific transgenic mice lines for these big five neuromodulators. There's also a technique called compound breeding. I'm just getting into the nitty-gritties of these experimental details. But with these compound breeding techniques, I'm sure it's very complicated. But in principle, assuming that it's seamlessly possible, so one could in fact try genetically, of course, label a certain neuromodulatory projection, like let's say histamine, right? And then tag these histaminergic projections to specific neuron types, let's say in the cerebral cortex. So that way, it would enable trying to quantify, for example, what's going on in a population of layer 5 pyramidal cells in the neocortex upon activating histamine, right? So that way, you're somehow trying to come midway in terms of a top-down approach, in that you're trying to understand what's happening to a population of neurons under a certain behavioral paradigm and how a certain neuromodulator is actually regulating this behavioral paradigm, right? Mm-hmm. So that way, we're actually bringing these two approaches, like what I'm a fan of, partly a bottom-up approach, and what I know about Mac's own work, in that he's trying to build mean field models, population level models of network activity. So I think that way we would really try and merge these two complementary perspectives to try and understand what a certain neuromodulator is doing to a specific population of neurons under a behavioral task.
Yeah, I mean, regarding the biological details, and there are many studies that are using novel approaches like optogenetics. I think one of the principal, and also really important findings reported in Science, you know, comes to dopaminergic modulation on cell morphology, and really goes down to the fine level of dendritic spines. And so this way, so they there's a group of Japanese researchers, so they study the striatal medium spiny neurons and use kind of really refined time scale as well. So they found that the dopaminergic regulation can kind of enlarge the spine, on the dendritic spine of a certain neurons within a short time window of 0.3 to 2 seconds. I think this is one prime example of using novel technologies to really, you know, go into the biological detail on the smallest possible spatial scale you can have. And also, like, a lot of projection specific studies on the goals of, for example, cholinergic cells are relying on the same techniques, or sometimes two photon engaging as well. So two photon microscopy, you know, a combination of this with the optogenetics, which is also done by this group of Japanese researchers. We also done, like, in other studies that are studying the projection specific functions of, for example, noradrenergic systems, such as for example, Uematsu did. So they published their studies on Nature Communications. I think it's Joshua Johnson's lab. at RIGAN, and they were trying to unlock the function of an autonomic system with different projections for different functions. So like it's more like sensor perception as well as fear conditioning. So in this way, we can really kind of more comprehensively understand the diverging function of the same system within the same area across different areas depending on their projections, and also in kind of an intricacy between, the interactions across cells within the same microcircuit, for example, within the basal ganglia, the D1, D2 cells, as well as the cholinergic cells that are regulating their behavior. So I think it's definitely contributing to a more comprehensive understanding of what convergence, divergence are going at the local, more global scale.
So we've been talking about neuromodulators largely here, but May, you mentioned your interest in you mentioned Blake Richard's work incorporating like multi-compartment models of units instead of just point units.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys talk about that in the paper, but you don't go into as much detail as you do with the neuromodulator story. But what I was going to ask is how challenging it will be to... So my first thought was that it's a lot more straightforward to incorporate dendrites, let's say, because if you model them all the same anyway, then it's almost like just modeling another computation, right? Mm-hmm. Like another activation function almost.
Sure.
In just at higher scale. But then you mentioned that, you know, if you're going to model like the size of the dendrites changing and their... I guess that's in some sense like modeling a weight change to a dendrite differently, right? Over the course of all the dendrites. But then neuromodulation with all the interactions seems to me at first pass to be a much more complicated thing to model, to figure out.
Exactly.
And okay. So I'm wondering if you guys agree with that, building in the dendrites, for example, or multi-compartment models, if you feel like that's a much more straightforward process than modeling in neuromodulation?
Sure, that's one way to do it. But there have been efforts to try and systematically collapse the biological detail into simpler models.
Yeah.
Mainly through ways of retaining this biological complexity through some kind of activation functions, right? That could represent nonlinearities in dendrites, or could also represent synaptic conductances on dendrites,
mm-hmm.
right? And then to account for the fact that these conductances, when they're activated at the synaptic location on dendrites, but by the time they get to the soma, are severely attenuated, for example, in mm-hmm. Leiva pyramidal cells and things like that, right? So mm-hmm. so there are ways to do this. So I think, a more efficient and a smart way to try and see how to incorporate a neuromodulation into such a framework would be to ride this bandwagon and see, so how can we capitalize from this whole infrastructure that's being developed to try and collapse biological detail into something that's more simple, that's more tractable, and then use this framework to try and also incorporate like neuromodulatory receptors. I mean, ultimately what this means is this could just be another set of activation functions, because the way these neuromodulatory receptors also work is pretty nonlinear. So this could be like another set of complementary parallel activation functions that could go into such a modeling framework. So this is one way to do it, and there are groups, for example, like Inan Segev's group or Ivan Soltesh's group that are actually trying to look at ways to simplify all the complexity out there, and yet somehow retaining this flavor of complexity. So what this enables us to do is to model and simulate networks that are not as expensive in terms of computational infrastructure, and yet the beauty here is that they're retaining a lot of the biological complexity.
Yeah, so according to me, what's interesting is also, you know, in addition to the above-mentioned points Sri had, I think what's interesting is that there are already, like, this established approaches to computer neuroscience allowing us to do that. For example, they have, you know, so how they are actually modeling neurotransmitters and neuromodulators actually through the ion channel kinetics file, you know, mostly like COD neuronal. No, like the neurosimulator mod files. So they're kind of a really like investigating the biological literature and how the neuromodulator affecting the local inductances and also excitability of a cell. And they kind of bridge this into mechanisms within the mod file. So I think we can do something similar. And we, as Sri said, we can pretty much like model a cell with a changing excitability using, for example, also like alternating activation functions, mm-hmm. right? Because what takes to trigger a cell to spike at a certain time point can differ from another time point depending on the events right. and scenario it's in. So we can kind of model this kind of excitability change or production change as something that's more, you know, commonly used in you know, like deep neural networks as activation functions or hyperparameter change. So there are always like parallelism in between the two, but we just wanted to open like this discussion that there are really like all these neuromodulatory effects at different levels, including the fine dendrites, and the cell can really behave differently under different contexts. And that I think that's mm-hmm. also like one point of the paper. And so we really want to bring that into a scope.
A lot of what we know from neuromodulators in particular, bringing it back to neuromodulators, is through mammals, right? Mm-hmm. Mice systems. Do you think that there's any reason to look across different phyla? Like, I don't know anything about neuromodulation in the octopus or the shrimp or something, or, you know, it doesn't have to be a sea animal or birds, right? I mean, do you think there's any use in studying the different capabilities of different species mm-hmm. and their set of neuromodulators and that landscape? Or do we need to focus on things that we're so interested in ourselves, our mammalian mm-hmm. selves, that human is the goal, but you know, there's a possibility, this wouldn't be inventing new ones, but incorporating across species principles, right?
So maybe actually, Sri, please go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So I think a lot of the neural mechanisms that underlie the evolution of behavior is pretty much remarkably conserved across species.
Yeah, that's what I thought, but there must be differences. Mm-hmm. There must be appreciable differences.
Indeed. Yeah, so, okay. I mean, as species have evolved, right? So, of course, the size of brains have of course, remarkably changed. There's also the aspect of more neurons, perhaps more intricate dendritic architectures that could then invariably support more receptor types and things like that. So I think overall, the primordial function of certain neuromodulators is pretty much conserved across species. But indeed, with evolution, there are also certain nuances. For example, I don't know if the octopus brain would have the same kind of receptor diversity for histamine as the mammalian brain.
So, I don't think octopi don't sleep, do they?
They probably don't.
I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, they probably have some kind of a quiescent state. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, because since you mentioned histamine, so that triggered that.
Oh, okay. Wait. So again, we've traditionally studied the role of histamine in the mammalian brain in relation to sleep and wakefulness.
Right.
I think it's histamine in itself is a distinct neuromodulatory system that's probably doing all kinds of things. I mean, there's a lot more evidence now that it's involved in regulating gamma oscillations and things like that. So all I'm trying to say is that it could be that given the fact that the architecture of neurons is a lot more complicated across the evolutionary tree, that there simply is room to support more receptor types that could do or that could bring about assorted functions upon the action of the same neuromodulator. But overall, I think this basic function is probably conserved across species. But the nuances is what sets the function of neuromodulators apart from invertebrates to vertebrates. And this is something that we simply don't know much about.
I mean, I think an interesting example is that, again, we have different purposes in different disciplines. For example, if we discuss biomimetic design in robotics, it has a different meaning than what we have in neuroscience, right? So they pretty much like use an exoskeleton or other kind of simple architectures, mechanic ones to simulate what the animals are, how the animals are ambulating or stuff. And I think for different subjects, for different areas, we have different goals. For example, the reinforcement learning in actual scenarios, actually, like the danger of avoidance or, avoidance behavior is actually one important point of discussion, right? So we avoid the danger, we kind of preserve ourselves within a wild environment. So this is their focus of study. So I think it's kind of interesting to study different organisms depending on the question you want to answer. For example, lampreys, there are a lot of studies by Sten Grillner studying the lampreys and the central pattern generator. And also Eve Mutter, as you mentioned, her really famous study, she used the crustacean. You know, these are simpler networks and are easier to test. And also the crustaceans that have different kind of neuromodulators, for example, proctolin or something else, not the same as a big four as what we have in the brain. So there are a lot of primitive functions that are largely preserved, for example, fight and flight, and also, the preserving body heat and certain body temperature reflexes. These are already preserved, and there are like a higher diversity when there comes to higher domains, cognitive domains such as social functions, executive functions, and there is a big divergence between like individuals, and we can even have subtypes of cognition in people. In our paper, like there's a figure representing different spatial temporal, specificities of neuromodulatory functions and processes. And on the higher, temporal and then the spatial scale, we have longer extending functions, more like continuous feedback and learning and processing of bees. And I think this is something quite specific to mostly mammals and human that possess social function and ask us to really like react in a kind of a really complex environment. I think these kind of behavior demands are really different from other species. And I think that's also one interesting point. And having all this, the knowledge of all the different species are definitely interesting for us scientists to build different model mechanisms to address certain questions. Because, sometimes the ambulation on a really bumpy terrain by people is definitely something that's less well studied, because we are not advancing on that. We are not surpassing certain species on that because we don't navigate well on this kind of a terrain, right? So really depends.
It should be studied more, if not just for comedy.
Yeah, exactly. So it really depends on the question we wanted to answer. And this is also, I think Sri and I earlier during the year and last year, we wanted to think of a future study, where we focus on the evolutionary perspectives of neuromodulations, how it changes from a perspective that is more primitive and, just basic life function preserving to something that's more elegant and involving higher cognitive domains. We wanted to understand how this is related to the evolution of the brain and increasing folding of our neocortex. So maybe we'll have this study in the future. Yeah.
Tiny questions then. Sri, go ahead. Sorry.
So I think Corey Bargman has actually been doing a lot of these seminal studies, really only looking at the role of specific neuromodulators in an extremely primitive organism like the C. elegans, right, with 300 or so neurons. And yet, remarkably, this primitive organism displays a very rich repertoire of behaviors, due to neuromodulatory function. For example, right from olfaction to something else. And it seems that these neuromodulatory systems are conserved across phylae, like C. elegans all the way to the mammalian brain, where it seems that these similar neuromodulators are involved in olfaction, for example. So that's really remarkable. But the question obviously is, how do these neuromodulatory systems also scale As brains expand with the number of neurons and also their architectures and different brain regions and their interactions, and how is this primordial function actually conserved despite this whole combinatorial explosion? So I think this is really fascinating. This is really, really remarkable. As May said, we're trying to really skim the surface of how this could be possible to provide some perspectives.
That is even a larger question, I suppose. But if we're at 3 on a scale of 0 to 100 in terms of what we understand about neuromodulators, and 3-ish on a scale of 0 to 100 and incorporating that and making it useful in deep learning networks, there's certainly a lot more work to do. So I look forward to a lot more of that work from you guys, and wish you luck.
Thank you.
And appreciate the conversation today.
Thank you for the questions. Yeah, it also leads to more thinking. I think we'll have discussions, you know, internally and also with the wider public regarding our work and the things we can do in the future.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Paul, for the chance to chat with you, and for the great podcast. And hopefully a lot more people would realize the urgency of the problem and try and join hands with us to crack neuromodulation a lot more efficiently in the coming years. So, or maybe in the coming months, we don't know. We'll see. The more hands we have on board, the better, of course.
There you go. You heard it, listeners. It's a call to arms to join the cause. So, all right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sure.
Brain Inspired is a production of me and you. I don't do advertisements. You can support the show through Patreon for a trifling amount and get access to the full versions of all the episodes, plus bonus episodes that focus more on the cultural side but still have science. Go to braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thank you for your support. See you next time. The stereo.